I am Plant on the Line here at thecommentary.ca. The 100-mile diet from Random House has been on the bestseller list already, and its authors have been lauded in reviews in this country and beyond. This isn't a diet like Atkins, rather it's a delightful book on a Vancouver couple's adventure to eat food grown within a 160-kilometer radius of their apartment. It's not a bad way of living, and probably a whole hell of a lot safer than Atkins. I am joined by one half of that couple, J.B. McKinnon, who with Alyssa Smith have written an often funny, engrossing, and remarkable look at the food they encountered. It shines a necessary light at the food we consume. James McKinnon is the author of the 2006 Charles Taylor Prize-winning Dead Man in Paradise. He's the winner of 2 National Magazine Awards and is a senior contributing editor to Explore Magazine. He also used to edit Adbusters. He joins me from Toronto, where he's participating in the Idea City Conference. The 100-mile diet retails for $32.95. In the United States, it's published under a different title, Plenty. I am pleased to welcome to the Plant on the Line program, J.B. McKinnon. Good morning, Mr. McKinnon.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. One of the interesting things about this book that you talk about that I probably haven't thought about before, and I probably should, is the state of the Canadian farmer. You've met a lot of farmers along the way in this country and in the United States, as a matter of fact, traveling down there. How are they coping?
Well, it really depends. At this point, we really have two types of farmer, really, in North America. One are the farmers who work the very large-scale industrial farms with a lot of support in some cases, particularly in the United States, in terms of subsidies for their crops and things like that. And I think those farmers, at least financially, are faring fairly well. But the other type are the small lot farmers, you know, what people would think of as the more traditional family farm. And that more local food system has really been left to languish for half a century or more. And those really are the farmers that they kept Elisa and I alive during our 100-mile year, because it's the small lot farms that are really feeding the local food systems, maintaining crop diversity, and really playing a big role in local economies.
You live in Kitts, is that correct?
At the time of the experiment, we lived in Kitts. Yeah.
100 miles from the, I guess, Greater Vancouver, you know, the boundary, you know, boundary to UBC, etc. 100 miles from there, what sort of food is grown within that radius?
Well, a remarkable variety of food is grown. When we started out on this diet, a lot of people, including ourselves, really thought that it could end up being the most boring year of eating in our lives. You know, that we would just be eating beets and turnips and parsnips all year, because that's what people think of if they think of what can be grown in Canada. But really, we found an amazing variety of food, many of which we'd never tried before at all, let alone tried from a local source. And even more surprisingly, I think, what we found was that historically, the local food system was even more diverse than it is now. There were, of course, a few exceptions, a few things that we could not find.
What were some of those things that you had to go without for the year?
Well, if we think of the conventional diet that most North Americans are eating now, we had to go without a lot of things. For one thing, virtually every variety of processed or packaged food was off limits for us. I think we could say that with the exception of wine, nothing that we found that was being grown locally was also being processed into a more complicated food item. And then, of course, tropical fruits and some of those sorts of things were not available. The real tricky one for us was wheat, and that was unexpected. We ended up searching high and low for any kind of supplier for wheat or wheat flour, and eventually concluded that wheat just doesn't grow on the coast. That, with a little more research, turned out not to be the case at all, and in fact, historically, there have been times when the region region of around Vancouver would have been actually self-sufficient in wheat, and would have had all different varieties of wheat. But because of economic specialization, we really don't have it now. It took us 7 months to find one farmer who was planting 4 acres of wheat a year.
And that was that's the scene in the book where you're separating the wheat from the rat crap?
Actually, that was the first wheat we found. We did, quite early on, we actually did find one farmer who'd grown a trial batch of wheat, and he had decided not to try it again, but he did have a one-ton bag of it waiting in his, or just sort of going to waste in his barn, and invited us to come out and help ourselves. And yeah, when we dug into that bag, we found that we were not the only visitors that bag had seen, but all of the other visitors were rodents. So the wheat we took home there, let's just say that not every grain was a grain of wheat.
What are some of the places that you went to around here, and where? I guess it'd be the Fraser Valley. You go to Richmond, any?
Yeah, I mean, if I think of some of the real hot spots for local food, I think of places like Agassiz and Rosedale up the Fraser Valley. I think of Westham Island and Delta, the Gulf Islands, of course. Salt Spring in particular is a real hotbed. Even places like Pemberton, with its, you know, it specializes in potatoes and just happens to be precisely 99 miles from Vancouver. You know, others for some of the seafoods, the area off the Sunshine Coast is really, really rich. So we got around a lot, but we actually found that in a general sense over the year, the diet kept shrinking. I think it really ended up being more like a 50-mile diet by the end of the year.
Was that because you found that you enjoyed certain foods more than others?
It really was just the easiest food to get, and was closer to home, because as I say, the local food system really doesn't have a lot of structure to it as it stands right now. So it, you know, you're really relying on the farmers markets and farm gate sales, and you really don't get a chance to jump over to a place like Saanich on Vancouver Island very often to sort of sweep through and buy local food.
Now, you and Alyssa are both vegetarians, correct?
We certainly were when we started the experiment, but we entered the experiment with an open mind that may have to change, and it did.
So what were some of the rules then that you put on this one-year diet that you embarked on? That you would eat seafood and that sort?
Yeah, I mean, certainly none of those things were rules, but we just really were committed to eating within that local range and seeing what that would tell us about our food system. And we realized pretty quickly that the familiar proteins for vegetarians, things like nuts or dried beans or soy products, simply either were not available or certainly weren't commercially available in this landscape. So what we've discovered and often say is that a vegetarian diet and even a vegan diet is theoretically possible on, at least in the Vancouver area, but currently it is impossible because the crops aren't being grown. So we had to turn to things like eggs and dairy and seafood and ultimately even meat, and that really was a really interesting journey for us.
The other interesting thing that I found was that you discussed, both of you, your childhoods and how that affected the way you both reacted to food. You seem to be quite adept in the kitchen. That's not from any training, is correct?
Yeah, absolutely no training. And I think it would be a matter of some debate whether or not I'm adept in the kitchen, but I am certainly somebody who is who's willing to experiment in the kitchen, and I'm not. Not only am I not unafraid of trying a new food, but I seek them out actively, and that was really exciting over the year, finding all of these foods that I'd that I'd never eaten before. I mean, even things as simple as purslane or collard greens, and then right through to, you know, a little bit more exotic foods like, say, the fruit. There's a fruit called the medlar, which actually has to be frostbitten to be eaten, or spot prawns, which are a local Pacific prawn, but one which I'd never eaten before, and I don't think I'd known anyone who had.
Are Alyssa's habits, are they the same as yours, or are they, I gather they're different?
Alyssa doesn't cook, period. But she was raised in a family where she was never really taught to cook, and where the idea of cooking, I think, struck her as a non-feminist, non-modern sort of thing for a woman to do, and her ideas on that were challenged and reshaped, I think, over this 100-mile year as well. And she certainly became the queen of the food preservation in our household. So she led the charge on things like pickling and canning and things like that that really were necessary for getting through the winter on local food.
I don't think I've asked you yet, but whose idea was it to go on this 100-mile diet?
Originally, I guess it was mine, and Alyssa was doubtful, to say the least, at first, and then thought about it a little bit more and decided that it was really worth taking a stab at. And then, of course, there's the fact that I do the cooking anyway, so she was kind of hostage to my choices.
And throughout the year, had she taken to it? Did she enjoy the experience, or did she learn to loathe it?
No, she absolutely loved it, I think. We both, when we got to the end of the year, we really had to, we had the moment where we had to decide, well, are we going to continue to eat a local diet, or are we going to go straight back to eating from the global supermarket the way we used to do? And there really wasn't any debate or discussion about it. We're still eating about 80-85% local, and we're quite comfortable there, and still finding new foods and just really enjoying the process of it.
You have a place, both of you, in Doreen. Is that how you pronounce it?
That's right.
That's north of Vancouver. That's, I guess, geographically, I guess, close to Terrace, right?
That's right.
How often do you spend there?
We get up there each year for about a month's worth of days.
And I guess I'm thinking of that first meal. It's the first meal in the book that you discuss. And you had people over. You had nothing really prepared. And what was on that menu that night?
Yeah, well,
that came from just within the house, I guess, right?
Yeah, it was really just drawn directly from the landscape. It was more like a 100-meter diet. We caught a fish. We had actually planted some potatoes and some garlic months earlier, and we dug those up. There's an old apple orchard in Doreen, which is essentially a ghost town, and we managed to get some apples and some wild rose hips, and we went out and foraged for some mushrooms with a couple of friends who are field biologists and knew how to get us through that process without poisoning ourselves. And it really was just a fantastic meal, and I think really a trigger for the whole experiment, because we realized that it was the first time any of us could really remember knowing exactly where all of our food had come from, and really knowing the story of our food from start to finish.
Going on this year-long adventure, knowing where your food came from, I think, was one of the main goals. Do you find that people generally want to know more now?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are more and more reasons for people to feel some urgency about knowing where their food is coming from and how it's been produced and what's in it. And the range is everything from, you know, the food scares around things like E. coli straight through to genetic modification of food or heavy chemical pesticide and fertilizer use, and goes, you know, continues on to, particularly for people who eat meat, a lot of concern about ethical and humane treatment of animals. There are just so many questions that people have now about their food, and in this sort of global industrial food system that we've developed, there is almost no traceability of food and almost no transparency in the system. So there's quite a strong swing at this point. Certainly, there's an emerging movement to demand that local food systems be strengthened again, and that we focus more of the energy and the efficiencies that we've built into the global food system on the local food system.
We live in a city, James, where there's a large immigrant population, where ethnic food is you know, on nearly every corner, if you will. You lose out on that when you sort of eat locally, because most of that food that's ethnic is imported. Can you have sort of the ethnic flavors with food that's grown within a 100-mile radius of Vancouver?
You can. I mean, you can and you can't. I mean, there are a couple of ways that I'd respond to that. I mean, one is that it's quite a new idea that that we should be able to have food from any part of the world available in any other part of the world at any time. And unfortunately, you know, our desire to have that kind of ultimate choice has come at a pretty serious cost in terms of the environmental consequence of food production and the transportation of food around the world. On the other hand, we're not suggesting that all people should eat 100% local food all the time, but rather that the core of our diets should come from the local foodscape, and that we then really draw on the global market just for our treats. So under a regime like that, I mean, if we look at most of the foods in the world, many of them are, the core ingredients of many of those foods can be grown on our landscapes. And it would really only be a matter of, you know, of supplementing that rather than drawing all of those ingredients from around the globe. And maybe one of the most exciting things for me over the entire project was realizing that we don't really know yet how far we can go in terms of what can be grown in landscapes like the one around Vancouver. So over that year, we encountered Indo-Canadian farmers and Chinese-Canadian farmers, Asian-Canadian farmers, even farmers from Guatemala who were trying some of the local crops that they knew from home, and in many cases were finding that they grew just fine.
Is this a diet that only few can afford? I'm thinking if you've got, you know, two or three kids and you're barely making ends meet, this is obviously not something that you would prescribe. Or subscribe to, pardon me.
What we say is that, in terms of affordability, it's been tried at the average weekly food allowance of a typical North American. It's been tried at even at the federal food allowance for the U.S. welfare rate, and it's possible at all of those levels. But unfortunately, because of the focus that we as a society have put onto building a really efficient global system, the local system is simply not as efficient as it certainly could be, and therefore, in some cases, is either expensive or certainly inconvenient. But one point that I would want to make is that none of that should stop a person from trying to eat more locally, more often. It's not, local eating isn't something like vegetarianism where you do it or you don't do it. It's something that you can do at any level on a spectrum from 0% through to 100%. And if a person wants to try to tap into their local food system and reconnect with people who produce their food, if they want to make a small environmental contribution through their food choices, it can be as simple as switching from a glass of Florida orange juice to a glass of BC apple juice in the morning, and you know, any of those small steps will be interesting for people and valuable.
Was it harder for the both of you because at the time you lived in an apartment, you didn't have room, let's say, you know, you didn't have a backyard where you could plant a garden, for example?
Yeah, I mean, that's really why we chose to do it the way we did. We wanted to do it as a couple of pretty typical urban dwellers with a one-bedroom apartment inside the city, no access to a backyard garden. All of it is still possible. I mean, we ended up finding a plot in a community garden that we were able to do a minimal amount of gardening in, and we had to do some pretty innovative storage within our apartment. But we certainly proved that it's possible.
And do you find after your year-long adventure that there are more places, there are more outlets to get locally grown things? Have you noticed a greater demand, not just because of the two of you, but other people?
Yeah, I mean, this emerging local food movement is already transforming the system in a few different ways. I mean, last winter was the first winter that Vancouver has had a winter farmers market, and if we had had that market during our 100-mile year, winter certainly wouldn't have been much of a challenge at all. There was an incredible amount of food available. More restaurants are focusing on local ingredients and a wider range, you know, not only the sort of highest-end restaurants, but restaurants that are more accessible to a greater number of people. And the grocery stores are starting to react. I mean, there's certainly debate about labeling foods according to where they come from, and we could see changes like what Elisa and I saw in the southern UK, where there was a store that we visited near Brighton that had all of its food shelved according to how far it had traveled, and none of the food had traveled further than 50 miles.
I'm interested in how this book came about. How far into the year did you both decide that this is something that you two would write about and write about together?
It was kind of an idea that came to us in a sense. I mean, we started out the diet really just as a private experiment between the two of us, and hadn't even necessarily thought that we would write about it in any form. But it turned out to be more interesting than we expected, and we ended up writing dispatches on it for the Taillis.ca, a local news website. And the interest in it really just took off from there, and pretty quickly we were hearing that there was definitely publisher interest in it, and we responded.
You're both notable writers in your own right, each of you. Was it easier to write together because you were a couple, or was it more difficult?
It was definitely more difficult. We've never written anything together before, and in fact, we tend to be quite independent of each other in terms of writing. We don't do a lot of, certainly don't do anything like workshopping, writing together or anything like that. So it was, it was definitely a new process for us, and like the diet itself, it had some stressful moments.
Alyssa, I guess she's not part of this conversation, so I guess we can talk about her. She obviously is quite revealing in this book. You less so. Was there a reason for that, or is that just the way she is?
In a sense, we did make some decisions early on, and we talked about who would carry a little bit more of the, I guess in a sense, the more strictly political elements of it, and who would carry some of the more personal narrative elements of it, and really, you know, her personal narrative had had some greater strengths than mine did through the year. So when she started writing, she was immediately writing towards a personal narrative. So we just encouraged that. I mean, we just tried to encourage each other to stick within the bounds a little bit. But of course, we both cross over. I do share some more personal narrative material, and she certainly includes some of the more informational and more political elements as well.
Has this affected your relationship in any way, doing this diet and writing this book? Do you think it has? I mean, it sounds like, but after reading the book, you know, these are the things you wonder about.
Yeah, it's a good question and kind of a difficult one, but the diet itself was a really deeply satisfying process in the end, and it had its challenges and its weird moments, especially at the outset. But by the end of it, you know, we really felt immersed in a sense of place in Vancouver in a way that we never had before. And because that was a shared experience, I think it ended up being quite powerful in terms of the way both of us view the relationship. And the writing, I think, I'm not sure that we've sort of settled on a sense of where that's taken us yet, but I think in a sense it definitely helped us understand that in many ways we're also both very independent of one another. So we had the diet being very much a bonding experience, and then the writing, in a sense, reasserting each person's individualism.
What are you working on now, may I ask?
We're really working on a lot of our time right now is spent within the local food movement, which certainly isn't anything that we ever expected. But we're doing a lot of talks and a lot of work within that emerging movement. That I think is mainly the focus of Elise's work right now. I'm also doing working on a collaborative book that's been underway for a couple of years on displaced people, and it's a book of art and text, and that's coming out in 2008.
How have you reacted, both of you, to the reviews of the book and people's reaction to it? I mean, people think it's at first a novelty, and then they think, well, yeah, it does make some sense.
Well, for the most part, we've really been heartened by the reviews and the attention paid to the book. I mean, it's certainly been a successful book for us, and successful also in the sense that we feel like we're participating in something that's being built by a lot of different voices now. You know, this local food movement is I think really poised to change the food system in much the same way and to the same degree as organic food has over the last 10 to 15 years. So that's been really exciting. If there is a downside, it's the reduction of the idea. And in some cases we find that the idea of local eating is being reduced to just a challenge, or a question of how difficult it was, or in a sense taking the limitations that we set on ourselves in order to push us through an interesting thought process, and kind of, I guess, turning them into strict limits or definitions of local eating, and we certainly never had any intention of that being the case.
This is an interesting book, and I want to congratulate you both for writing it and compliment you on that, and continued good luck with it, James, and give my best to Alyssa as well, and thanks for joining us today.
All right, well, thank you very much.